Hello and welcome to My Career in Data, a podcast where we discuss with industry leaders and experts how they have built their careers. I'm your host, Shannon Kemp, and today we're talking to Christine Haskell.
With a robust catalog of courses offered on demand and industry-leading live online sessions throughout the year, the Dataversity Training Center is your launchpad for career success. Browse the complete catalog at training.dataversity.net and use code DVTALKS for 20% off your purchase.
Hello and welcome. My name is Shannon Kemp and I am the Chief Digital Officer at Dataversity. And this is My Career in Data, a Dataversity Talks podcast dedicated to learning from those who have careers in data management, to understand how they got there, and to talk with people who make those careers a little bit easier. To keep up to date in the latest in data management education, go to dataversity.net/subscribe. Today, we're joined by Christine Haskell, the founder at Christine Haskell Consulting, LLC. And normally, this is where a podcast host would read a short bio of the guest, but in this podcast, your bio is what we're here to talk about. Christine, hello and welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad you're joining us today. So, you've spoken at a lot of our conferences and a lot of our events, and I'm so excited to hear how you got into data management. So, tell me, you know, as an independent business, you know, what do you do for your clients and how do you work with data in your job?
I empower data leaders to transform their cultures and to make data an integral service. And I do this in a couple of ways. I observe and listen to leadership to tailor solutions. I assess sponsors and teams for what literacy skills they want to develop. I collaborate with data leaders to help them determine a unified approach to data project management and change management efforts. I facilitate workshops that increase data awareness and impact. And my approach comes down to proven methods, adaptive capabilities, and customized toolkits. And I do workshops and consulting engagements and teaching and research and all kinds of different approaches to that.
Oh, I love that. you work with a lot of data.
Yes.
So let's back up then, you know, tell me, Christine, you know, when you were say, 6 years old, is this what you wanted to be when you grew up? That like, oh, I'm going to grow up and own my own consulting company and help people with their data.
No, I don't think I showed up to kindergarten with my briefcase and something. I always was a big reader, and I remember, I had a big stack of National Geographics, and I was the kid reading the backs of cereal boxes and collecting labels, you know, for like adventuring and anthropology and Tomb Raider kind of stuff. And it was into science and things like that. But I don't, it wasn't a huge leap for me to end up in English literature, right? And fiction is where you find the most realism, ironically. And I was always interested in human dynamics and psychology. And later I was drawn toward advertising, where it was some of the smartest people I ever met, and particularly drawn to human behavior side of things, where, you know, why we buy and why we do the things that we do, and became inspired by sort of this anti-corporate movement when I was graduating. Companies like Yankee Candle and Boston Beer and American Girl, those were all early companies before they sold out, that organizations were pioneering sort of new forms of capitalism. And then the internet hit. And I had this sort of like kind of, you know, it was at the height of the recession, kind of graduating at the height of the recession. And I remember, you know, just these waiting rooms filled with 40-year-old men, and these beige cubes going into nothingness. And I was like, I can't compete. Like, I can't, you know, and they weren't looking at candidates without experience. And the internet was a place of great diversity. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, anyway.
Yeah.
And it was, they were hiring sociology majors and English majors, and it was just this incredible opportunity. And long story short, I ended up on my last dollar in New York with an interview in this little loft in Hastings, New York, overlooking the Hudson River. And it was this sort of quintessential kind of startup on the water. And I was bombing, like just bombing. And I'm like, I have to end it. And so I looked at the guy and I'm like, look, I'm not going to get this job. It's perfect for me, but I'm not going to get it. And so if you could just give me some feedback, I'll be on my way. And he was like, sit right here. I'll have someone interview you. I'll have someone for you to meet. And he put me through the whole loop. And that was Seth Godin. That was Yo-Yo Dine. We got acquired by Yahoo. And that was it. Like, I was sort of like, I got my break. And, you know, it was a great ride. And I really fell in love with online consumer products and the data behind all of these products and like why we make these decisions and why we click where we click and the systems that enable the features that we play with. And we were doing data before anyone else, like permission marketing was early data projects. And Yahoo was doing data, the advertising, tracking eyeballs and all of that stuff. And so all of those companies gave me an early view of business intelligence before that became a function. So that was sort of my path into the data space. I never could have planned it.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I love that. So, okay. So back it up a little bit. So, okay. So again, what was your major?
English.
So, and then you go out and there's not many job openings, but there's this new, and you just know you don't want to live in cubicle world.
Well, yeah, I mean, the only jobs when you're graduating, then it was like, you can go write a manual or you can teach English.
Oh yeah.
So I'm like, it just felt like I was being paid to hold my breath underwater.
Oh yeah.
I can't do it. Like that's not. And so, you know, there were no product management disciplines. There were no degrees in any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of a wide open territory. Like it was like, you could kind of do anything.
Yeah.
Web mastering was the only title that was out there. And I had, by then I had kind of talked myself into some roles. I had done, the first online database for the Kauffman Foundation. I had, as an English major, I had talked myself into a role for the back end. I had programmed the back end database using Cold Fusion.
Oh, uh-huh.
That was an engineering role.
Uh-huh.
And I learned Cold Fusion code without, there was no manuals and there was no, you just sort of had to learn by doing.
Yeah.
And I cried every day. It was so hard. And, but it was an education and it was a whole different way of thinking. There was another guy and myself on this job and the two of us just figured it out. And it was like rewiring my brain.
Oh my gosh. But was that your first job out of college or
that
during
was my,
college?
That was my second job out of college. My first one was HTML coding in the president's office and kind of teaching that department. That was what kind of early webmastering job.
Yeah.
And sort of making the website there and coding again. So again, you know, kind of moving into the coding space. But it was a whole new set of skills and it was a whole different way of thinking, a whole different side of my brain that was getting activated and thinking. And it was a way of organizing my mind and kind of tapping into a completely different skill set that I didn't know I had. And sort of, it was a learning under duress. Would be one way to put it, but you know, sort of stress.
Sure.
Learning was one way to, you know, and it was learning to pay the rent, right? It was like learning skills to literally pay the rent, and but diversifying in the moment, right? And and while I wanted to move in the advertising space, there was just nothing there. And but it was 20s is the time to really do anything, say yes to everything, and I did. So HTML and engineering code, and then I went into marketing and event management and you know. And so I, and this was the time when opportunities were coming and going, because it's a very tumultuous industry. These companies were tiny, the opportunities were tiny, and everything was like, it was like ducks being pulled underwater, right? Like it comes and goes because it was such a tumultuous.
Yeah.
It's nothing like it is now. Like startups is a known idea.
Yeah.
Then it was a huge career risk. Like if you were going to something that you had to explain this stuff to your parents, you had to explain it to your peers, like your own graduate student, your own kind of peer group didn't understand it.
Yeah.
Nobody had a frame of reference for what these careers were. And it was like you'd kind of fallen off a cliff. You went off the map where the dragons were, and like nobody kind of knew what you were doing. And so, yeah, HTML and all this stuff was like foreign. And so you were really taking a career hit moving into this space. And it was almost like you could have said you were mining minerals on Mars. That's sort of what, and they were like, good luck. We wish you well. And so that's what that first 5-6 years was like. And I moved from Boston to New York literally on my last dollar, and I'm in this interview and just torpedoing it. Just like, it just was not going well at all. And then it did.
That's amazing. I love that. I love that story. I love that you're like, okay, this isn't going well, but you know, so tell me why I didn't get it.
Yeah,
and then you get it.
I need to get out of here because this is not, this dog's not going to hunt. And it was one of those things where I borrowed my parents' car, which was a tank, you know, and I got the job ad and the classifieds, you know, and found it in the paper, and it was torrential rain, and I'm just like, I just gotta get out of here because this isn't gonna work. And tell me what I need to know to leave. And I went through the whole loop and was all the brain teasers, was all the things that you would expect in the 90s, like, you know, manhole covers, like, why are manhole covers round, and all the thought teasers and the logic questions and the thing. And I did it, and I lasted, and I made it, but it worked out. But it was awesome. It was a neat ride.
Oh, that's very, very cool. And I love that you worked through that challenge and just insisted on pushing through and learning until you could make it.
It was a lot of tears.
Yeah. But you did it.
A lot of tears.
Oh my gosh. Amazing. And it paid off.
Yeah, it did pay off.
Yeah. Do you look back and go, I'm so glad I went through that?
Yeah. I mean, I had a diverse portfolio and met some really great people and had, you know, I got bright and shiny projects and, you know, worked on Yahoo Calendar and I had some great brands on my resume and made it to Seattle, worked at Real Networks and then Microsoft and, you know, the rest of history. So,
yeah. Oh, well, let's go through some of those too. Okay. So you're in New York, you've been acquired. So now what?
Well, I got acquired and I got a one-way ticket from New York to San Francisco and moved to San Francisco and I'm working for Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the real estate was bonkers in 99. And I remember, I get out there and it was like, I don't know if you know the book Microsurfs.
Mm-mm.
Heard of that? That's a Douglas Copeland book. I highly recommend it for those who are interested in the Gen X culture. He wrote a book about Microsoft in the 90s and it really kind of encapsulated my experience in tech around that time. But it was another world. Like I left a blizzard and I'm in my parka and my duck boots with, I mean, I'm, I don't know, I was like 26 and I come laden with New England all over me, right?
Yeah.
And I leave the plane and it's 70 degrees and there's palm trees and, you know, yoga, smell of eucalyptus, and like, you know, it's a completely different place.
Right.
And it looked like it just popped up 50 years ago. Like it's, everything's brand new. And, you know, I immediately embrace the West, you know, hiking all the time and going out in the sun. And in New England, you know, when it's sunny, you're out. And so yeah. I was out all the time, but I was working a lot. I mean, it was a hard culture.
Yeah, sure.
So you're working from what, 7 to 10, you're working from the early morning to late at night. It's a sweatshop, it was a startup, and everything about the startup is true. You're working. I mean, that misquote that the Google's, what's his name, mentioned, where he misspoke. Mm-hmm. Oh, I forget who was it that said it?
Was it Eric Schultz?
Yeah. He said, you know, they decided they didn't want to compete and work from home. But that is the truth. I mean, a startup is when you're competing, everyone is there, and that place is operational 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And the reason that stock was at 420 when I was there was because we were there 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And that's why stock is high. And it's because it's off of people's backs, and don't think that's not happening.
Right.
And so when the weekend hit, I was in my car and I was hiking for 48 hours straight. Nice. So I would be in Muir Woods back when you didn't have to sign up to go, because I think now the waiting lines are so long you have to sign up to go in. But I was in this cathedral of sequoias and it was incredible. And I would just go just to be out of the technology. And it was religious for me. And I would just go to kind of like, I just needed to not vibrate anymore, you know? And there was a guy selling Cisco stock. Like he was yelling at his stockbroker, like short it now, you know? And I'm like, I gotta get out of here. Like I can't, this place is crazy.
Yeah.
And so I floated my resume up in Seattle. And like, I've always been curious about, it seems quiet. Like it seems misty and quiet. Like I could, that's the place like I could jive. Right.
Yeah.
And so I've been here about 25 years ish and really like it. It's a nice place, a nice part of the country. And I don't think it's an accident that there was a lot of software engineers up here, because it's dark and rainy and a lot of socially avoidant people end up living here. And it's famous for mushrooms. Like that makes sense, you know.
So. So you're moving up. Did you go to Microsoft then, you said?
I went up here for Real Network. I got two jobs.
Real Network. Uh-huh.
I got one from Blue Nile, which used to sell, I guess it still does, sell diamonds over the internet, and one from Real Networks. The only reason I didn't go to Blue Nile was because I couldn't explain it to my parents. Like, oh, there's this company that sells diamonds over the internet. And I was like, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Like, even though it's brilliant, and it was a brilliant model, and I think they made a ton of money. At the time, Real Networks was like a mature startup. Like they were at the time, I think, I don't even know if they were like 8 years old, but they were like the big competitor to Microsoft, and they were bringing audio, video over. They are why we are talking over the internet in video.
Yep.
Right now. They were an amazing company, and they could have been YouTube, like they could have been so many things, but they didn't. And anyway, so I ended up going to Microsoft a couple years later, and really kind of marinating in the discipline and contributing to the discipline of business intelligence as it became a formal function, which was, again, another really amazing. That was an amazing ride also. And I wrote about that. That was kind of what contributed to the book as a body of knowledge. One of my first bosses wrote the foreword for that. And, you know, that's...
And which book is that?
I'm sorry?
Which book is that?
the book that I just published in February, Driving Data Projects.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you, Chad Richardson. Yeah, he wrote the foreword to that. And we met in 2003, and that's about the time when he approached Satya for the big check to invest in business intelligence as an idea. Mm-hmm. And developed the Cosmos platform, and that was the foundation for data for Microsoft at the time for a division, but as a company. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the kind of principles that we operated by are in the book. But that was an 8-year journey to maturity, and a lot of bloody knuckle learning, you know, a lot of tears from a different for a different reason, right? Like not just sort of yeah. hitting your head against the wall of slow change, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More and more companies are considering investing in data literacy education, but still have questions about its value, purpose, and how to get the ball rolling. Introducing the newest monthly webinar series from Dataversity, Elevating Enterprise Data Literacy, where we discuss the landscape of data literacy and answer your burning questions. Learn more about this new series and register for free at dataversity.net.
Oh my gosh. So I love all the learning and the challenges that you take on here. So Microsoft, and then what?
Then I did a ton of projects in Microsoft over that period of time, and we get to a level where we're sort of off script, but I'm just sort of riffing on this.
Yeah, that's good.
where I land our first governance program, and we're amassing budget. There's a question that's persistent that kind of gives me pause, which is, what does the data tell me to do? And it's not unique to Microsoft. It was sort of pervasive across the industry, but it made me kind of stop in my tracks. And the way that it was phrased, which kind of hinted at an abdication of critical thinking. And it's what made the language of data-driven versus, I forget the other alternative. I talk about it in the book, and it's a popular phrase, data-driven versus data, kind of bringing the thinking back into the conversation. And it prompted me to go get a master's in applied behavioral theory and continue on for my doctorate in IO psychology, and to understand more about human bias and decision-making and leadership, because the problem isn't in the platform. The problem isn't in the technology. The data is operating as designed. It is the bias that we're programming into it. It is the lack of awareness that we have when we're using it. It is the lack of critical thinking or insight that we're bringing to it. And the inability to challenge its output once we get it. And these tell me features that I'm seeing come in software packages now, and the fact that AI is so readily available to everyone and so easily consumable, and it's so competent, you know, as we're playing with it. It sounds so good. And mm-hmm. I use this with my students. I mean, it does sound good, right? So if you don't know how to challenge the output, or you don't push back on it, you're not adding any value to it. And that lack of dialogue, that lack of reasoning with the box, is a problem. It's a real problem. And so that is what I'm really focused on now, is that reasoning capability and value adding capability, as a literacy and fluency, skill. And both in the governing area and in the change management area, and as a literacy skills for sure, but as a leadership skill. And so that's my current focus, both in the teaching arena and the research arena and in the workshop and kind of consulting area.
Oh, that's amazing. So what made you decide to kind of go out on your own and go into teaching and leave the corporate world?
Well, I've been teaching for a long time, sort of in tandem with my work. I just really enjoy it. It's just a way to give back, but it's a way to, you know, kind of keep a foot in both worlds and keep sharp on the theory and continue. Mm-hmm. I just enjoy research and writing. And I think, you know, the market's just always shifting. So I, you know, was laid off from Salesforce about a year ago. So hanging my shingle became a way to kind of stay in the flow.
So fascinating. So, okay. So I missed that you went from Microsoft to Salesforce.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then, and now on your own, mm-hmm. again, I just, it's such a journey of curiosity and then I love that you continue to get educated. I think, you know, I keep coming back to that. It's kind of the commonality that I find with data people, right? It's just that curiosity and that desire to learn, that passion to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So Christine, tell me, what's been your biggest lesson so far in your career?
I think there's a few. I think, you know, people referred back before data was a function or business intelligence was a function. I was in operations and IT, which is sort of where data sprung from. And they would refer to those functions as plumbing work or sort of the grunt work of that area. And I never understood that. I've always thought that operations work I've always regarded it as extremely creative and highly strategic. And you need to be a very clean thinker, mm-hmm. and an elegant problem solver. And this is where, like, my brain literally feels the same as when I coded in that back-end database programming. Like, you really need to think logically to get the most efficient and effective distance between two points. And I didn't say the shortest because people are involved, right? So there's, yeah. You know, whenever people are involved, and this is sort of the next lesson, is that efficient and effective have to be for both data and people, because data and people are both very messy.
Yeah.
And project managers often forget that. And project certification and project information often forgets that, because they look at the world in terms of checklists. So understanding aspects of change is really critical. And so I think that that's, and I emphasize that in the book heavily and sort of blend a methodology for that reason, because it's the people aspect is really essential.
Oh, so true. So having worked with data for a while now, so what is your definition of data?
Well, I actually talk about this in the book as well. I love this. I actually looked it up when I was writing about this, and it's both a noun and a philosophy. Don't you love that?
I do.
And as an English major, I love it. Like, it really, when I smiled when I read it and when I wrote about it, because I was like, oh, I love that. Like, the noun part is facts and statistics, and the philosophy part are things known and assumed to be facts.
Mm.
And I think that's significant, and it speaks to me from a psychology standpoint, and it speaks to my career in data. And it says something, I think, about our societal state as well, that everything counts as data.
Yeah.
And it means everyone's right. And that's, I think that's telling.
Mm-hmm.
And that we're all under the same tent, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
And so I talk in the book about how data is many, many things. Like, it's information and language, and it prompts feelings, and it can be art, and we regard it as an asset. But ultimately, I think that it should be a great source of humility, that you know, for leaders at every level, that everyone needs to be more comfortable and confident communicators with data, and that we must challenge where the data comes from and understand if it's clean enough, and observing data is sometimes sufficient to make a solid decision, you know, from a trend. you know, for other decisions, specific data is needed, but, you know, conversations about data, such as understanding our colleagues' logic in a building and building a business case or justification of a decision, are just as valuable as the data itself. And so humility is something that has to be modeled. And leaders have to demonstrate a genuine humility with data, especially senior sponsors of initiatives. And that's not something you see a lot of in organizations where a manager or a leader, and they're also the ones that carry culture through their behaviors, right? How what's permissible? What is considered okay to do, right? Is it okay to ask questions? Is it okay not to know something? And how does one demonstrate that genuinely, right? Mm-hmm. Like, do we all understand what we mean by ethical decision making? Like, can we kind of go around the room and say what we mean by that, and give an example, you know, just so that we're all on the same page. Like, what would an open discussion even look like if it's not modeled?
Right.
Because we all know what to put for compliance videos. Like, we all know what the wrong answer is for legal compliance training and go through the motions for that stuff. But when it really comes to the application of policies and stuff, and things get real when the business is trying to negotiate with the data team on, you know, how we're going to put the stuff in play, the compliance videos aren't there.
Right.
So humility is, I think, really important.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And if you decide to queue up that conversation, Christine, I'd love to sit in. I think it would be amazing and fascinating. And as an analyst, I love the conversations of just, you know, what does a word mean and just what do we mean by this?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I just get into it. So
I think it's fascinating because no one ever agrees. I mean, just definitions, just the metadata of things, there's never agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that as a kind of a corporate anthropologist, because you just sit there and watch the language go around the room and what do people value and what do they cling to and what do they, you know, what do they hold dear and what are they willing to cast aside? And all that stuff is so telling around the cultural, you know, the things that they're trying to hold on to and why.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you then see the importance of data management and the number of jobs working with data increasing or decreasing over the next 10 years and why? How do you see this evolving?
Well, I mean, I'm seeing things evolve right now just with the AI injection in job descriptions, like just in the roles that I do, strategy and governance.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a blog post. We should have a whole podcast on this. There's some coding requirements like R, SQL, and Python are being injected into strategy and governance roles when they're not needed.
Mm-hmm.
And, their recruiters are using AI to do job descriptions, and they're sifting out probably 85% of their viable candidates that way.
Mm.
And I don't know if they know that, and or maybe they do. I don't know, but they're if they want a metadata cataloger as their strategist, they're not going to get a real strategist. If they want double duty, what they're doing is attracting a vertical thinker.
Mm-hmm.
They want like an ex data strategist or an ex architect as a strategist. That's a horizontal thinker. And what they're doing is getting they're monocropping.
Mm-hmm.
They're not getting a diversity of thought, and it's sort of the antithesis of what started the internet, right? Which is this diversity of thought.
Yeah.
You got so many diverse heads around the table. I mean, I really couldn't, I cannot stress enough how many degrees we had, and how many diverse degrees we had in that original startup. It was like the UN.
Yeah.
I mean, zoology, it was fish and wildlife, like it was everything.
Wow. Yeah.
And just everything. And you would have these ideas coming from just left field, and they would work. Like it was just, you know, things just, you know, because you had different thinkers. And when you get this sort of myopic, you know, this sort of groupthink going on, they don't negotiate the same way. And then you're going to get this siloed view. And I mean, it makes the book that I have more relevant than ever, because these people have a harder time, even harder than horizontal thinkers, negotiating with business stakeholders.
Mm.
It's twice as hard.
Very much so.
Generally speaking.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to build that diversity. Yeah, the ego doesn't want us to do that, but it's so important.
But data teams, I mean, even though people want to put us all in the same bucket, it's a diverse neurodiverse group.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you need to populate that. You need to populate that diversity intentionally.
I think that's what I love about data. And I do think the jobs will expand as more companies pay attention to their data. I think, and that's kind of why I started this podcast, just to talk about, you know, the diversity of, and the lack of linear path to data, right? And how it does bring that diversity, because there's currently no, you know, degree in data modeling or, you know, that kind of thing, or courses or, you know, so at least collegiate, but yeah, it's really, really exciting, I think, and very good advice. So then what advice would you give to people looking to get into a career in data management?
I think there's much more of a straight path than there used to be.
Yes.
And much more available information. And I would say, you know, buy my book. I'm just kidding. But I think beyond curiosity and passion, which I think passion is really bad advice. I think it's to become a clear thinker.
Mm.
And clear thinking is one of the biggest lessons that I've come to learn. And it came to me the hard way. And there's an emotional and intellectual component to that. I was diagnosed very late in life with high functioning autism, as well as phonological dyslexia. And before I had awareness and after I had awareness, I have the same thing in common. I can't control, and I will never know how people feel about me, right? But it made it easier to accept that, oh, this is just what it is, right? This is how I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, I don't care what people think. Like, it's not like an FU. It's just that it is what it is. And being honest about how I'm feeling, or instead of retreating, like I'm feeling insecure, or I'm a little bored with what we're talking about right now, or like just being straight.
Yeah.
You know, and that can get validated for whatever reason, because I'm making it funny, or people thought it was a joke so they can hear it better. You know, that's what helps a depressed state of not knowing how people feel about you. And that's the only thing I can do, is to be honest in that moment. And the best way of being honest is to be in touch with that feeling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me, that's what makes me attuned to my coaching. It makes me attuned to my stakeholders. It makes me attuned to myself. And those are the things that help me connect with others. And that is something that I really, really, really struggled with growing up. A lot of what I learned and experienced through life is through nonverbal observation. And there is, you know, so that I'll not go through what education and adult development misses in trainings, because I just think there's so much that we can learn about autism and neurodivergent people in terms of, like, we learn so much through mapping, sports and arts and things like that, through nonverbal communication. But there's a whole segment to be done on that. But I think it's become really chic to call this type of classification a superpower. And we put this burden on neurodivergence to be either this kind of rock star savant like Bill Gates, or who honestly has his own behavioral tics. He just has really good PR. Or pity the person who's like rocking in the corner. He can't tie their shoes. And there's this kind of silent majority who are just not at the same party as everyone else, right? Sure. And they need to learn how to give each other safe places. And the intellectual component is, I'm just a natural builder. And I think in both abstract and strategic terms. And that's something I learned about myself when I was doing the coding and came out, you know, as an English major, and I forced myself to do coding. And I just love building frameworks around messy problems. And I get into the details as well. And so I'm always tying theory to practice. And so my managers would have, you know, a part of the business that was like a bramble thicket, and they knew they could drop me in that area and I would turn it into a Midwestern grid system by the end of the year. You know, so when you find how to think clearly about a problem, everything, and I mean everything, falls into place after that.
Yeah.
And it's about aligning your skill set, whether that's graphics or UX, or in my case, being a word nerd or a framework, you know, person. You know, thinking about problems in the right way with the right people.
Mm-hmm. So I really, really, really appreciate you sharing that, and getting personal and vulnerable, you know, and I think that's such an important message and great advice, you know, too. And so just to kind of define, you know, clear thinking, just really being honest with yourself and knowing yourself, so you can adapt and I think that works for any career, not just in data management.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Christine. I really appreciate it. This has been such a pleasure. I really have enjoyed talking with you today. If you would repeat for us one more time the name of your book and where we can go buy it.
Driving Data Projects, a comprehensive guide, and it's on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
I love it. And if people wanted to solicit your services, how would they find you?
ChristineHaskell.com.
Perfect. Oh, well, Christine, again, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And to all of our listeners out there, if you'd like to keep up to date in the latest podcasts and in the latest in data management education, you may go to datoricity.net/subscribe. Until next time, stay curious, everyone. Thank you for listening to Dataversity Talks, a podcast brought to you by Dataversity. Subscribe to our newsletter for podcast updates and information about our free educational webinars at datoversity.net/subscribe.